Welcome to the Saturday night edition of the Sunday Morning Linux Review with
Matt Enders,
Tony Bemis,
and Mary Tomich.
All right, what's today's date?
Today 14th? Is
the 14th.
January 14th, 2012.
Third show of the year?
Yes, third show of the year.
14th episode.
And you know, the third time's the charm, they say, so.
That's right. Well, we survived yesterday, Friday the 13th.
Barely. My That's laptop right. died yesterday.
And so
I'm very upset.
Oh.
So.
It died?
It died.
Completely, or did some
well,
aspect of it?
Is
it,
no.
is it not bootable, right? Hardware, software?
Just? I don't know. It mm-hmm. won't boot consistently, and sometimes the BIOS doesn't even come up. So.
Mm.
What happened was I thought I was plugged into a power source, and I wasn't. And I was just using it and using it and using it and using it. And then all of a sudden...
Completely disregarding the little battery indicator.
I wasn't paying attention. And all of a sudden, the screen just goes, boop, and I no lights. I'm like, oh, F.
Mm-hmm.
So then I plug it back in. And when I first plug it back in, it wouldn't boot at all. It wouldn't do anything. I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, no. So then I let it sit for a while and rest, plugged in. Mm-hmm. And then it booted, but it froze with only like half the desktop loaded. Like the start, what passes for a start button down in the lower left
mm-hmm.
wasn't loaded. And then the mouse and the keyboard stopped reacting. So then I had to hard boot out of that. And then sometimes the BIOS doesn't come up if I turn it on. It just sits there forever.
And
black screen.
This was, you were trying to boot Mint, right?
Mint has nothing to do with it.
Have you tried pulling the battery out?
I have not.
Because I haven't seen that happen.
And it doesn't boot consistently. And sometimes when it comes up, the wireless isn't active. And I do an RF. I did an
maybe
RF kill.
Maybe the power management.
An RF kill said
yeah,
it was
maybe
fine.
Maybe there was something. Hmm.
I don't know. But really, the BIOS doesn't even come up sometimes, so I don't know what the deal is.
Yeah, but you could pull the battery out and boot it just strictly from the...
But does a laptop still have a CMOS battery in them, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if I pull the battery out, what's good it going to do?
If the battery is shorting out, it would cause things to stop working. So you pull the battery out and just run on power.
Oh,
just leave it off.
Oh, you're an effing genius, dude.
Been working on the laptop.
We're
going to
expect a
years.
Report from you next week.
I got it here. When the show's over, I'm going to do it.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'll stick
Actually,
around
I have
for
had that.
But...
happen on me for two or three laptops I've worked on have done that.
Really?
Yeah.
And they work fine without the battery in them.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you plug the battery in, they say F you.
It just doesn't do anything when you plug the battery in.
This does sometimes it does nothing. Sometimes it boots. Sometimes it half boots. Sometimes the
maybe just something's loose in there.
Sometimes the radio works. Sometimes the radio doesn't work. But why would I think it's definitely got something to do with the battery because I totally killed it. And if you drain a battery, I don't know about a laptop battery, but like a car battery, if you drain it too much, you can actually reverse the polarity on the battery.
Yeah. Well.
Oh.
Laptop batteries are completely different.
Yeah.
See, car batteries are
really, Tony? Really, they're completely different.
No, positive and negative posts on them.
Even
right?
laptop.
No,
batteries,
there is a positive and negative post.
But not well. Not
even laptop batteries from 5 years ago or 10 years ago to the last couple of years, completely different. Because the new ones don't have any memory or anything anymore.
Right, because they're all Lion batteries.
Right, where the previous ones, like what this laptop has, that we're recording on.
Right.
It probably has something either similar to what you have or you have up to the new version, new kind.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like a 6-year-old HP, I think. I think it's 6-year-old.
Most likely has the older style. The new ones, there's no reconditioning at all. I mean, if it goes bad, it's bad. You have to throw it away. But on yours, you can actually recondition them.
Yeah, I know. I had an old ThinkPad that I had to do that to once. And it was like, it was amazing. It was I was down to like only 20 minutes of use on the battery. And then I did some research on the web and found out about this reconditioning. And I did it. And then I was getting like an hour and 40 minutes out of it. I'm like, woo.
Well, you know, I've got, and you probably don't remember this, but I have that, it's a Winbook. And I had it before I got that Dell XPS,
right.
Before I got my Zen.
Yes, I think I do remember that.
Well, that laptop is still limping along. But the battery is completely dead. I mean, if I unplug it from the power source, it dies.
Yeah,
immediately.
I had a really old ThinkPad that was that way.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that I don't know if there's something that can be done for that particular battery. It may be just totally.
I think at that point, if it's completely dead, yeah, then it actually has shorted out.
It's time for a trip to Batteries Plus at that point.
Yeah. Okay.
and the other option is
okay.
you can. you can actually replace the cells inside the battery.
That's what Battery Plus does. They'll rebuild it.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay. Well, that's a good point. I'll try that.
My old compact, the reason I was so hesitant to get rid of it or stop using it is because it had a feature right in the BIOS to recondition the battery.
That thing.
And when when I first got it, it had maybe 10 minutes of battery life. I found that in the BIOS, and I ran it, and the next day, it takes about 12 hours to run it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I had to give it a whole day to run, and then I tested it the next day, 4 hours of battery life.
Wow, 4 hours. Because I had the same thing in that ThinkPad, and when I did it, I went from like 20 minutes up to like an hour and 20 minutes.
So. Yeah. But it goes through like four cycles of completely charging and completely
and discharging,
and then completely charging and discharging, like four cycles of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That only works with the old lead acid stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Huh.
All right. Ready for the kernel news?
I've been sitting on the edge of my seat.
Just anticipation has been killing you.
Yes.
Already? All right.
Matt, what's happening with the kernel?
In the kernel news this week, there were no release candidates, and the mainline 3.2, there was no change. In the stable releases, Greg Cage announced the release of 2.6.32.54 kernel on 112. I got confused there because it was on the 12th.
Too many
12s. It was on the 12th, and on the year is 12. So it was on 112 at 813 UTC. There were 18 file changes, 167 files inserted, and 66 files deleted. He also announced on 112 that 3.0.17 was also going to be released. There were 52 files changed, 364 files inserted, and 179 files deleted. And then again, he also announced that kernel 3.1.9 it was released, and it had 53 file changes, 367 files inserted, and 179 files deleted. And then, believe it or not, there was also a stable update to 3.2, even though it just became the stable kernel recently. And there were 63 files changed, 465 files inserted, and 200 files deleted. And my kernel quote of the week is also from Greg KH, which stands for Crow Hartman, by the way. Here's the different active kernel versions that I am maintaining at the moment. 3.2.y, this will be maintained until 3.3 comes out. 3.1.y, there will be only one or maybe two more releases of this tree. And then 3.0.y, this is the new long-term kernel release. It will be maintained for 2 years at the minimum by me. And then there is 2.6.32.y. This is the previous long-term kernel release. It is approaching its end of life, and I think I only have another month or so doing releases of this. After I am finished with it, it might be picked up by someone else, but I'm not going to promise anything. All other long-term kernels are being maintained in various forms, usually quite sporadically, if at all, by other people, and I cannot speak for their lifetime at all. That is up to those individuals.
And that was a quote?
That was a quote from Greg Crow Hartman.
Hmm.
I was going to say that was a pretty lengthy quote.
Hey, now. There was also a bit of a dust-up between Tim Gardner of Canicle and Greg Crow Hartman on the kernel mailing list over the maintenance of the 2.6.32 kernel. Once Greg gives it up, it appears to have been started by a misunderstanding and a conclusion jump by Tim, but it was Greg kind of bitch-slapped him, and it was kind of cool. Like to see those Canicle guys get bitch-slapped once in a while.
Well, I suppose. Keeps them in line, right?
There you go.
Sure.
Okay. Well, that was pretty good. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome. And that's the state of the kernel this week.
All right.
Tony, what's going on with the Linux distributions this week?
We've got some distro releases this week. Starting back on last Sunday, the 8th, after we recorded, we had a release of... Where'd it go? Porteus 1.1. It's a Slackware-based live CD with a choice of Trinity, a KDE 3 fork, KDE 4, or the LXDE desktops.
That KDE 3 fork, is that that Trinity project? Oh, Trinity. Yeah, never mind. Duh-y! I'll just be quiet now.
That's right. Actually, Matt, it's your whole about everything you're against with KDE 4. I'm surprised you haven't, you're not running Trinity.
I just discovered it like a week ago.
Oh, yeah?
But I tell you what, that new cinnamon that the Mint guys are making, I am digging that desktop. It has some little quirky glitches in it that made me drop back to run Mate for most of the week, but I really liked running Cinnamon. It was really cool.
Cool.
This is the January 14th update of Matt's love affair with Cinnamon. All right. And what other distros, Tony, are you going to tell us about?
On the 10th, we have Fuduntu. Fuduntu? It's a...
Fuduntu?
Yeah.
Did we skip over Ghost BSD?
Ghost BSD is...
It was a ghost. We didn't even see it.
I just got to stop talking this week.
It's a dev release.
I am just all over the board.
Yeah, it's all right. So we have, it's 2012.1, so their quarter release of the updated distribution for forked from Fedora last year. And that's the one where they forked Fedora to make it look like Ubuntu.
Yes. It's that's why they called it Fuduntu.
Yeah.
I'm like, just get a life, guys. I mean, run Ubuntu. But we love the RPM. You're an idiot.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they could write maybe they have written, I don't know much about it myself, but maybe they've written a script where you can just take Alien and behind the scenes do all of that or something. I don't know.
It's possible.
Yeah.
All right. And then we have Asterix 4.
Asterix?
Asterix. A-S-T-U-R-I-X.
I was going to say Asterix is a... VoIP server.
I know. And when I saw that name, I thought it was going to be a VoIP server, but it's not. It's an Ubuntu-based desktop distribution with customized desktop environment and many usability improvements.
Another Ubuntu spinoff. Yeah. You know, I think what I'm going to do maybe for next week is I'm going to go and I'm going to count how many there are, and I'll report back during
the segment. There's only a couple that's like blessed by Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a ton that are spun off that, you know, that don't get the Ubuntu name,
mm-hmm.
like these Asterix and, although within,
Mint.
Yeah, and Mint, but within the DistroWatch website, you can say mm-hmm. what it's based on
and show me, and say show me all of those,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And then we have Astaro Security Gateway 8.3.
Yeah, I did not know they were a Linux-based distro like that. I thought that the Astaro Gateway was Linux-based, just mm-hmm. from what I've seen of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not know that they released a distro. I thought they did like a Red Hat kind of a thing, and just if you wanted it, you had to go to their website and dig the sources
right.
out from wherever and compile.
Well, I do know they do the enterprise-level like routing and,
yeah.
and security stuff.
Right, right, right.
And I had looked into it, but it looks pretty complicated when I was looking at it at the time. I'm not sure about it anymore, but... and like I said, maybe this is a newer thing where they're releasing it. Because I did look, I looked at quite a few firewalls about four or five years ago, and they didn't have a download available. Anyway, continuing on, we have Web Convergence 11. I know they had released just, I don't know, last month?
Yeah, not too long ago. I remember you saying something about them.
Yeah, but it's basically just a web browser on a... You know, a Ubuntu, or what did I say? You know, on a Linux desktop, and it's for internet kiosks. So there's not much they can do with it. Anyway, continuing on.
We browse the web.
Yeah.
They can do that.
Browse the web for an internet kiosk. On the 12th, we have FreeBSD 9.0 is released. It's the major new version of BSD operating system featuring a brand new system installer.
Hmm. Yeah. Sounds good.
See, there's a couple other development releases, but we also have a BSD, or PC BSD 9.0 was released, which is the one that's based for, like, your desktop. And that's all I see. Did I miss anything, you guys?
No, I'm done with all of it.
All right.
Yep, and one thing I'll mention, This day in history, 10 years ago, I'm going to read the top 10 most popular Linux distributions. Number 10 was Zandros, Number 9 was Lindos. Number
Lindos.
8.
How many of them aren't even around anymore? So far we've got one, Lindos, which became Linspire.
Linspire, that's
and
right.
And now done.
That's right. Lycoris.
Lycoris.
Lycoris?
Lycoris?
Lycoris. No, this was 10 years ago.
Are they still around anymore?
I don't think so. They may have morphed into or merged into something else. But
it's Lycoris?
This one will be familiar, though. Yeah, Lycoris. Correct. This one will be familiar, Slackware.
Slackware, that was my first
ever. Sousa?
I have never run Slackware. Well, the closest I've come is I've run Vector on some things, and they're Slackware-based.
And, okay, number 6 was Sousa. Number 5, Sorcerer.
Sorcerer?
Yeah.
They're a from-scratch type distribution.
Are they? Okay. That was back in 2002. And number 4, Debian, a well-known distribution.
Debian rocks.
Yeah, Debian rocks. Number 3 was Gentoo. Number 2 was Red Hat.
Lycoris?
Was Red Hot, yeah.
Lycoris was last updated on Wednesday, the 27th of July, 2011. So
all right.
Say they're still active.
Yeah. Okay. And the number 1 Linux distribution 10 years ago today was Mandrake.
Oh, no.
Became Mandriva.
It became Mandriva, and it might be done shortly, according to the news last week.
Wow. Yeah, I can remember some of these.
Yeah, Slackware was my first server. It was just because the guy that I worked with, he's like, you got to do Slackware. And it was my first Linux server that I was running. And it was a file server, and actually I ran a web server and stuff from it. It was fun.
Mm-hmm.
But then once I found Debian, that's all I've run since.
That was
since.
It. Yeah.
Debian on the server, baby.
Yeah, I think the only server software I've installed was an Ubuntu server. But I remember the Lindos and slash Linspire and that whole click and run. Remember that click and run repository, which I think was just, well, at that point I was pretty new to Linux. I thought it was so cool because you get all this free software and, wow, it was just cool. So anyway, all right, well, I just wanted to share that little bit with everybody today.
Yeah. Well, let's go to this week, the top 5. Number 5, we have Fuduntu at 1433. Actually, it tied with Debian in number 6, they put it for some reason, at 1433. OpenSUSE is 1440.
And it's on the way down.
It is. Fedora's at number 3 with 1495. Ubuntu's at number 2 with 1873 hits. And
in the number 1 spot,
we got Mint.
With that, gotta love that minty goodness. With as many page hits as number 2 and number 3 combined. More page hits than number 2 and number 3 combined.
That's because your whole family keeps pressing the buttons here at DistroWatch.
Hey, I got 2 kids and a wife, and they got a lot of free time.
I wonder if that counts unique hits. I bet it doesn't.
No, I'm sure it doesn't.
Those mint.
I'm sure it doesn't, because then my kids will be wasting their time. But.
That's true.
Oh, all right. So, yeah, I was really interested in looking at that Trinity, because, it's interesting to see it out there, because there's so many people that complain about.
I thought you were a genome guy all the way. Come on.
Oh, and you guys, remember last week when we were looking at the various distros of the week, I think we covered Pear OS, and I believe I made the statement or comment that I was going to go home and install that and just check it out.
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, I did. I did install it on a virtual machine, and maybe I should have put it on directly on my laptop. But I have to say, I was a little disappointed in it. Some of the dialog boxes, the titles were in French, but the text was in English. Although I did was kind of a little savoir-faire, so I felt
practice your high school French there,
right? That's right. My name is Mary. Yeah. Je m'appelle Mary. Yeah. But anyway.
The only thing I can do in French is count to 5 because it's a sentence. Are you ready?
Yes.
The un, deux, trois, quatre, cinq.
I have never heard of that.
There you go.
Okay, but
now
anyway,
you'll never forget how to count to 5.
but it was fairly easy to install. It had a problem recognizing my monitor, my graphics, and so it just install just the standard one. So, but aside from that, I mean, it was okay. You know, again, I was just thinking it was going to be.
You think the lack of some of that graphic stuff was maybe because it was a virtual machine? Or was I not paying attention and you said that?
No. No, I didn't say that. And it's possible that it was. So maybe I'll try it again.
Yeah, just because I've heard that sometimes the virtual machine has a hard time with some of those effects. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I did. I noticed that I had to install some guest add-ins. Now I'm using VirtualBox, and I had to do that for because what I was doing virtually, I was running two screens. And I got it to work and everything. And you guys know that I had to install that other operating system for this one program that I can't run in Linux.
Right.
And, yep, I got it. I got the screens working just fine.
Dual monitor and?
Dual monitor and a virtual box,
wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was pretty pleased. Just had to tweak it around a little bit and looked pretty good.
Did you ever try running that program in Wine?
I did. I tried running it. Believe me, I tried running it in Wine, and it just what it is a charting program for financial instruments, stocks and bonds and commodities and that type of thing. And real time. Yep. And so it's just streaming data. And I thought I had it installed, and then the program wouldn't boot, or it was just something I just couldn't get it to go, and so I ended up having to run it in a Windows virtual environment.
Is it a popular program? Like, is it something that's used by a lot of people, Mary?
Well, it's Sierra Charts.
I have no idea what that
means. And you know, it's a charting package. So if you follow the markets like I do.
But is it popular? Like, do a lot of day traders use it and things like that?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say a lot do. I mean, I think there's probably a fair number that do. But
did you ever think about contacting the crossover people?
You know, no, I haven't actually. But what I used before I went to this particular one was Thinkorswim, and their platform, I believe, it uses quite a bit of Java, and I am able to run it in Linux, so that was nice. I mean, it has some limitations, but it worked fine. And then I like Sierra Charts because it's got much more flexibility, but the downside, of course, is I can't run it natively. Yeah.
You have to run it in that Redmond-based distribution.
Yes, that other one.
Have you tried seamless mode with VirtualBox?
Seamless mode.
What it is it takes, like, you can run.
I must
run,
not have if I asked that question.
You can run, you crank up your Windows virtual machine, and then you hit, like, Control L, I think it is.
Oh, yes,
and
I have.
And it actually drops your desktop off, but it leaves your individual Windows up and puts the start bar at the bottom. So
I can go back and forth without.
You can drag them between Windows, and it's awesome.
You know, I think I did, and I didn't even realize it because I noticed that it first of all presented me with some little dialogue box if I wanted to continue doing this thing. Because I thought, I'm moving this thing back and forth and kind of go into the virtual box and out.
Is that how you think you got the dual monitor running?
Yeah, that may be how I got the dual monitor running too.
Yeah,
just blind luck,
really cool.
You know.
I do that all the time.
For dumb luck.
Yeah. You know, I first heard about that in Parallels, or whatever replaced Parallels. My friend was telling me about it. He did it on his Mac. And I'm like, well, I've got to be able to do it in my machine. And I found it. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, and I think it was those guest add-ins that I had to install that really helped make that happen.
Yeah, it's because of the video driver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the only downside is I do not get the 1900 by 16 whatever native resolution that these widescreen monitors that I use have. So it's smaller, it's less, but I'll deal with that.
It's not so bad that it looks like a big clown desktop, is it?
No, not quite. But
I said,
there was 800. Yeah, there is an 800 by 600 option, but I managed to tweak it up a little higher than that.
I have a little story about that. I was at a teacher's desktop. This has to be 3 weeks ago. I was doing some work on the machine, and he was standing over my shoulder, and I'm like, Tim, why do you have this set to clown mode? He's like, clown mode? What are you talking about? I'm like, man, don't you notice that all these icons are so big and everything looks just all clownish? And he goes, you can change that?
Yes,
I changed it to 1200 by, no, like 1600 by 1200 for him. He's like, that's great, that's great. I go, jeez.
You probably had the color depth down to like 16 bit or something.
No, it was on 24, but... Oh. But geez, it was just, you can change that?
And you made his day.
I did.
All right.
Oh, that's a good story.
Yeah.
Well,
It's like that IT guy song. Have you ever heard that IT guy song?
No.
No.
Oh,
I can never remember. I can only ever remember the one line.
Does it
line.
Come with music?
It does. But
are you going to sing?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Maybe the one line. But in the one line that I can remember from it, it's like, sometimes he comes to your desk and he's there all day. Other times he walks up and hits caps lock and walks away. All right.
All right. It's on to the tech news.
All right.
Okay.
In the tech news this week, first, we have Microsoft now collects extortion on approximately 70% of all U.S. sales of Androids. LG is the latest victim to pay Microsoft's extortion demands. They are the 11th victim in this extortion scheme. Extortion is my word, by the way. None of the sources I used to write this used the word extortion.
So this is your opinion. It's an editorial insert. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. They're the 11th victim of this extortion scheme. A list of the other victims includes Samsung, HTC, and Acer. This leaves Motorola Mobility as the only major manufacturer not to sign an extortion agreement with Microsoft. I'd wager that Microsoft does not even approach Motorola, as Google now owns Motorola, and those pockets are deep enough to scare the Microsoft patent trolls. Microsoft now claims that they are collecting royalties on over royalties, by the way, in air quotes, on over 70% of all Android smartphones sold in the U.S. The terms of this latest agreement are unknown, as Microsoft makes part of the agreement that the parties cannot make public the patents covered by the Microsoft claims. In other words, a typical extortion agreement.
Yeah.
So.
That's just incredible.
I don't know how they get away with it.
Did you tell me, or did I hear that they make more money from that than they do from the sale?
They
of
make
their
more money
Windows Phone
on the extortion of Android producers than they do from Windows Phone sales. Yes.
Yeah, because they make the same amount as what they would charge to put Windows Phone on it. So if they have 70% of the market running Android that they're getting money off of, and then 5% that they're getting money off, they make 70% of their money coming in from mobile is because of these agreements.
Evil.
They are. They're just.
Makes me glad. I just got a new cell phone and it's a Motorola Android. So.
All right.
Running Android, I should say, and I'm glad about that. So. And any more?
Yes.
More tech news
have
for
a
us?
Couple more. The MPAA instigates a dust-up with Ars Technica.
Ooh,
on 110,
I like that site.
I do too. On 110, the MPAA, which stands for the Motion Picture Association of America, said on its blog, Ars Technica, a tech blog with a long history of challenging efforts to curb content theft.
What?
This entire claim by the MPAA appears to be based on the fact that Ars Technica opposes things in the past, like the broadcast flag, which would have allowed remote control of people's home entertainment recording devices, along with their stand against DRM that prevents owners from ripping legal backup copies of their DVDs. Ars also has publicly opposed the horrendous SOPA legislation currently in front of Congress. It is obvious that the MPAA's position is the wacky correlation of fighting for consumers' rights is the equivalent of having no enforcement at all. Not that any representative of the MPAA would ever engage in outlandish statements to further their cause, like this quote from Jack Valenti when he appeared before Congress in 1982. I say to you that the VCR is to the American film producer and the American public as the Boston Strangler is to one.
That's pretty graphic.
Does it get any better than that? I mean, Jack Valenti obviously dead now and no longer head of the MPAA,
but I think that, as I recall, and I don't know if it's really true right now because the economy is a little shaky, but as I recall, I think movie revenues increased after that.
They did.
So, I mean, who wants to see a movie on your home screen? Well, of course, these days now with 55-inch TVs, it might be a little better, but I still prefer large screens.
I like to see the movie. When I'm going to see on my TV at home, I don't watch much. Well, on one of the big screens we do with the Netflix, watch some movies, but I'm more of the TV is for TV shows. I'm not really watching too many movies on it. So. The United States migrates spy drone control panels from Windows to Linux. Last September, the ground control systems for the Reaper drones, which reside at the Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, became infected with a virus. When it happened, the Air Force dismissed this intrusion as a nuisance that posed no real threat. It was, however, taken very seriously. Still, the discovery of the virus on the Air Force's systems was a huge embarrassment. This is what they had to say at the time. The malware in question is a credential stealer, not a keylogger, found routinely on computer networks, and is considered more of a nuisance than an operational threat. It is not designed to transmit data or video, nor is it designed to corrupt data, files, or programs on the infected computer. Our tools and processes detect this type of malware as soon as it appears on the system, preventing further reach. They also went on to say, the ground system is separate from the flight control system Air Force pilots use to fly the aircraft remotely. The ability of the pilots to safely fly these aircraft remains secure throughout the incident. Screenshots of drone control computers posted by security researcher Mikko Hyponen, and I'm sure I butchered your name and I'm sorry, show that some of the systems have been migrated from Microsoft Windows to Linux. In a statement, Mikko Hyponen said, if I would need to select between Windows XP and a Linux-based system while building a military system, I wouldn't doubt a second which one I would take. So, yeah, so they're
running XP.
They're not publicly going to say, yeah, they were, because when in the other screen, in other screenshots from other times, like pictures of the room and things, yeah, you can see the Windows desktop, that Windows XP, mm-hmm, green rolling hills, whatever.
Yeah.
And so they're not publicly going to say what they're using ever, because it's the military and it's,
sure,
pretty critical stuff.
Sure.
But from his screenshots, you can obviously see that it's no longer got a Windows desktop,
awesome,
on some of these machines. So
yeah, that's
good. They must be in the process of migrating them over.
Cool.
And on my last story, we're back to Secure Boot. Microsoft locks out other OS devices using UEFI. Early in December, the Software Freedom Law Center warned the Copyright Office that some operating system vendors would use UEFI Secure Boot anti-competitively by colluding with hardware partners to exclude alternative operating systems. Microsoft did not dilly-dally in revising their Windows hardware certification requirements to prohibit other operating systems on ARM-based devices that have Windows 8 pre-installed. The certification requirements define, on page 116, a custom secure boot mode that allows for a user present at the machine to add signatures for other operating systems to the system signature database. Except in the case of ARM devices, custom mode is prohibited, and I quote, on an ARM system, it is forbidden to enable custom mode. Only standard mode may be enabled. All, go ahead, Mary.
Oh, I was just going to say now, ARM devices, they're more of the mobile
of
embedded.
Of the phone, yeah. I'll get to that. I'm going to be quiet. I'll let you keep going. Also, you will not be allowed to disable Secure Boot. And again, I quote from the specs. Disabling Secure Boot must not be possible on ARM systems. So, in other words, if you purchase a machine with an ARM processor running Win 8, it will never be able to boot anything else. This also brings to light that, surprise, surprise, Microsoft has been lying to us all along. I personally am shocked that Microsoft would be less than truthful in its statements. Until recently, this policy would have only affected Windows Phone customers. However, Qualcomm announced that they are going to manufacture Windows 8 tablets and Ultrabook-style laptops built on top of its Snapdragon processors that are ARM-based. Unless Microsoft has a policy change, these could well be the first PCs ever that will only be able to run Windows. SFLC, which stands for the Software Freedom Law Center, did predict in their comments to the Copyright Office, and I quote, that misuse of UEFI Secure Boot would bring such restrictions already common on smartphones to PCs. Between Microsoft's new ARM Secure Boot policy and Qualcomm's announcement, this worst-case scenario is beginning to look inevitable. So yeah, so it started, and the reason I thought when I first started researching this was they were doing it because of smartphones. So that you couldn't root your Windows smartphone based with an ARM processor and then run a Windows 8 phone,
yeah,
and then put Android on it, some Cyanogen mod or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's not because of this Qualcomm thing. So they made this change, and then Qualcomm made the announcement. So there must have been some kind of backdoor deal going on between Qualcomm and Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's my opinion anyway.
Sure.
Well, and you know, take a look at how Apple has locked software to hardware, and maybe what Microsoft's trying to do is create that same environment themselves.
Yeah, they're doing it differently. Apple did it by
having good products, solid software.
Well, and building and involved with the manufacturers from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that you couldn't use that software. It's just that it was made specifically for Apple, and Apple had the drivers, and that's what it was. You know what I mean? But especially when Apple was back on the PPC. It's not so much anymore now that they're on Intel stuff. But, yeah.
Well, you could dual boot back then. There was a separate program to allow you to dual boot. But that's gone away now. Like you said, it's because it's Intel. Anyway, they're Intel processing.
Well, and speaking of drivers, because you did say that about 2 minutes ago, Matt. I was gonna mention because I thought this was so cool. In my household, we put a HP color laser jet that will connect to the network wirelessly, the home network. Mm-hmm. That I run and maintain. Anyway, so what was so beautiful about it is that the Linux computers in the house, which are the majority of the computers in the house, were able to easily connect to that printer and print to it. The other operating system that I'm forced to use for a couple things, I had to go find drivers, and I still haven't gotten, I think one of them, I'm just haven't even played too much with it, but I had to get drivers to get to be able to print to it with the other. So, you know, again, it's just I wanted to share that because it just makes me appreciate what I'm using, Linux.
Yeah. So, you know, I've never really, especially you said it was an HP, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love HP anyway.
Oh, because their compatibility with cups. I've never ever had a HP printer that I couldn't run from cups.
Yeah. I agree. So, yeah, I have seen similar situation at home where I've got a wireless HP printer, but it's inkjet. Mm-hmm. But I just told my Ubuntu to look on the network. It found it. Mm-hmm. It had the drivers and installed it.
Bingo.
I didn't have to download anything.
You mean you didn't go to localhost :631 and do it that way?
It wireless.
Yeah, but no, that's the cups. Do it right now on your
laptop. Oh, no. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, the cups
interface. Yeah.
I've gone there and set stuff.
That's the way I always do it. I never do a printer any other way.
And then I try to kill a print job that wouldn't die.
I didn't know you could do it another way. I always go localhost :631.
Yeah, right even in GNOME, they have a printer management system, and you can add in printers. And that's all I've been using for years.
Maybe it's in Mint, too.
It might be, but I just do localhost :631. It comes from Debian because I've up until I ran just straight Debian even on my laptop and desktops and for a long time. So
yeah.
All right. Well, and that's your news?
That's it. That's all.
Wow, that was pretty good.
That's all the news I have
for
you.
That was good information, and I tell you, and you know, it's actually a great segue because I think last week I promised that I would kind of be the point person to follow the Barnes & Noble Microsoft lawsuit. And I went out and did some investigating, subscribed to a couple feeds, and unfortunately, as far as the lawsuit goes, I really don't have anything more to report than what I did last week. However, there was an interesting bit of news that Mr. Matt happened to forward to me because it involves Barnes & Noble, and I thought, you know, I'm going to take this and share it with everybody. But what it involves is there's apparently an ongoing kerfluffle, and I had to use that word, in some open source circles about Barnes & Noble's release of the Nook kernel source code, which is something that they're supposed to do, of course, under the...
And they have done.
Yes, they have done. That's right. Under the provisions of the GNU General Public License. Adam Outler, who was commenting on the XDA Developers Forum, XDADevelopers.com forums, noted, it would seem that Barnes & Noble is betraying the most sacred trust of things in the open source world, the general public license. As open source programmers, we all use the GPL daily. The GPL is what keeps open source work like the Linux kernel free, modifiable, and redistributable. I tried to compile the sources provided by Barnes & Noble, but they are incomplete. They will not compile. I'm not the only one. Others have tried and failed as well.
You actually can compile them, but they won't install.
Yes, and I'm continuing there because and that's the thing I wanted to also mention, because really the issue is not the code itself, but it's the signing key or the signature key.
Yes, correct.
And the fact that Barnes & Noble did not supply that, and the without that signing key, it's impossible actually to compile a replacement kernel with the source code that they provided, and that because the hardware is locked down and won't boot a kernel unless that
key's part of the
exactly. Yep.
But it's not that you can't compile it; you can still compile the software.
Because of that, they've said now the source code is useless, despite the fact it's probably all there.
It is all there except for the key.
Just for the key. Mm. And so, really, the crux of the issue apparently is whether that key is part of the source code. And I believe in version 2 of the GPL.
Which is what the kernel's still under.
That's correct.
Which is the correct version of the GPL.
Yes, because Linus Torvalds does not like
version 3
at all.
It would because...
Which I think, I believe that they're trying to say at least that that key fell under the scripts portion of it.
Right.
And that version 3 clarified the whole intent portion of it that was in version 2.
And it's because version 3, if the Linux kernel were ever released under version 3, it would practically kill the embedded Linux market, and that's huge. And Linus sees the reality instead of the pie in the sky stuff, and that's why it's never going to happen.
Yeah, and that's actually what he said too. He and other high profile developers who've rejected version 3 have indicated that lockdown systems are permissible use of Linux, the Linux kernel, and are in full compliance with the version 2 license. Now, the important thing about that is that. Well, that first of all carries a lot of weight because when you if you go to court and you're presenting before a judge and the author of the content is in favor of that particular position, then anybody who's trying to go against it is going to have a very tough uphill battle on
correct.
Their hands.
Yep.
So anyway, I thought that bit of news on the Barnes & Noble front was pretty interesting.
Yeah,
so I've become a Barnes & Noble fan
yeah.
girl now.
Yeah, so have I. I love Barnes & Noble. And the reason, one of the reasons I love them the most is because they're actually taking Microsoft on this. They're not caving into their extortion, and good on you, Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, yep. I like that.
And I'm going out to buy a Nook.
I'm
going to.
Because we had a demonstration at MDLUG last month. Because this month's meeting was just today.
Yeah, in December.
Yes.
Last month, December.
Which would be December. And that demonstration was a rooted Nook, so.
Mm-hmm. I know, I really like that. I liked the whole idea of that, and so I'm going to go out and get one. And following the instructions from Ars Technica very closely and the XDA Developers Forum, I'm going to give it a try. So I'll either have a nice brick or...
Well, you can't really totally brick it.
Okay.
What you've got to do is you've got to back up the image first.
Yeah.
So worst comes to worst, you can reinstall the stock image.
Yeah.
So
that sounds really cool. I want to see it when you get it done because I didn't make it to that meeting to see the rooted Nook. I'd like to see that.
I thought it was kind of cool.
It was very cool.
Yeah. So anyway, but that's the Barnes & Noble news for this session.
Sweet. Right. You know, I found an article that it was over on MedGadget.com, and as it sounds, it's a medical device. But
really?
Yeah.
On MedGadget?
There's a multiple disciplinary. Yeah, no. Is that how you say it? No. Multiple disciplinary. No. I don't know. People from different disciplines.
There you go.
It's a team of engineers that got together from the University of Washington and University of Santa Clara, or Santa Cruz, or I guess that's University of California in
Santa Cruz. Yeah.
They've developed a surgical robot. It's called the Raven 2.
The Raven nevermore.
They're going to build quite a few of these and send them out to the different universities to test it. But what's really cool is it uses the open source robot operating system so that anybody can program for or develop and program for this robot that they're building for this to do surgery and stuff. It's pretty cool.
But Tony, did you tell us what that robot does? Is it surgical?
It does. Yeah, that's it.
Is it? All it's, right. Any particular specialty? Or is it just a general practitioner
Well, I think that's
robot?
What they're developing right now is right. whether But what it has tiny little arms or hands in there that can go in and cut and do whatever.
Okay, for those of you listening, because this is a podcast and not a video cast, Tony's wiggling his index and middle finger
and
his thumb together, going
tiny little hands. All right. So anyway, and so this robot, so it stands right next to the surgeon, or is it something that kind of comes down?
Like, is it a remote thing?
Is there a picture?
It's all in development right
now.
There is a picture. It shows, it says it has 7 degrees of freedom. So I'm not entirely sure what that means. Yeah, it's not, it'll be in the show notes, so anybody can go there at this point.
Yeah, but I'm trying to go there now.
medgadget.com, and then open source surgery. I don't know what's on the main page. But it does show a picture of, like these little. It looks like there's six hands coming in, or it actually just looks like little needles coming down that will do surgery on you.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's about halfway down the page, toward the bottom of the page. It was posted on January 13th. But it looks like just this table with six, you know, like gigantic needles coming in.
Oh, that looks like some kind of medieval torture device.
No.
But I'm sure that it's a wonderful thing for.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool because it uses the open source robot
monitoring system. I get distracted by all these other articles on the way there, and I start reading. I'm not even scrolled down the right place yet. Here we are. Open source. Wow.
Wow. Doesn't that look like that a medieval torture?
Medieval torture device.
It does. For the Inquisition.
Yeah.
No, seriously, though, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, but there's going to be... So it says there's 7 units of this will be made so that researchers at Harvard, Johns Hopkins, University of Nebraska-Lincoln, University of California, Berkeley, University of California, Los Angeles, while remaining the two other systems at University of California, Santa Cruz, and University of Washington. So, that looks really good. I mean, and then a lot of you wonder with robots how well that can work. But if you think about it, if you remove the
they do a lot of robot surgery right now. Like, mm-hmm. And that's for remote situations where, like, say you're out somewhere in Woojibooji, Alaska, and they have a clinic right that has one of these remote. Surgeons in it, but no surgeon within 1,000 miles.
Oh, yeah.
Then the surgeon remotes into the machine and performs the surgery with the machine.
As long as the internet doesn't go down.
Yeah, there you go. Or is a satellite connection and your latency's high. That could be a problem, too.
No, actually, robots use a lot more now. It's like around here, you see commercials for the cyber knife and things like that. And so it's really cool because you can do a lot more precise and you don't get the surgeon's hands like
that shake a little bit or whatever.
So it's a good thing.
Yeah, that would not be a good thing.
Right. Cut the wrong thing. I have a couple points of
general interest.
General interest. Yeah.
All right. We're generally interested.
January the 20th on Friday. That's Penguin Awareness Day.
It is.
Penguin Awareness Day.
Yeah. While the actual National Penguin Day is in April sometime, I think April 20th, but they thought January would be a good time to have Penguin Awareness Day.
Well, it's in the middle of winter and penguins are
I think everybody
animals.
Should wear a tux on their tux pin.
I am not wearing a tuxedo. You have got to be insane.
Yeah.
And neither am I.
Yeah.
Also, the Raspberry Pi that we talked about a couple episodes ago, it's gone into production.
It has, but did you see the betas? They sold the betas out really fast to developers. They were the only ones that were allowed to buy them. And then did you see what they did with the last two?
They put on eBay, didn't they?
They did.
Yes.
Well, Mary, you checked on the price.
Well, yeah, what was...
I think it was as high as $2,700.
Yeah, crazy.
For a $35 or $25
device. It's insane. Just for the cachet of saying, ooh, I got the last beta.
Yeah.
But I think one thing that was really good about that is, beside the fact that the folks at the Raspberry Pi Foundation got this money is that they took it, and I believe it, some of it went to a charity, or it went to a charity or something.
I have no idea.
Or maybe they are a charity and they got it. So, but certainly some good work, and I'm looking forward to getting my hands on one of those little.
Yeah.
Several of them, actually.
For development, it's really good for them for development. They get a little bit extra cash so they can make better products.
Sure.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You know, CES is coming this week.
It's happening.
It already
opened? It's over now, I think.
It's done?
I
thought it was just starting.
I thought it was all week long.
Yeah, probably, yeah. And you know what released 30 years ago at CES? A Commodore. Commodore turns 30.
That's right. You know what released at this CES?
What's that?
Ubuntu TV.
I did see that.
Oh, you know, I didn't see that.
It's a television that runs Ubuntu.
It looks really cool. You know how they have, right now in Unity, how there's the different lenses or different like things you can...
When he says Unity, he means the desktop that sucks.
But it's like that for channels. You can just scroll through channels, and I saw a video of how it works. It looks really cool.
Oh, just a little bit of an aside, though, on that Unity thing, and I remember how I said that I did have it on a netbook, and so for the amount of time I was using it on the netbook, it was okay. Well, my laptop did die, so I was using that netbook fairly a lot this week, actually just in the last couple of days, and the Unity interface was so annoying that I actually installed LXDE and switched over to LXDE on that little netbook. I just couldn't take it.
You know, I've seen it. Now, I don't run it, but I've seen it, and... It doesn't seem that bad to me. I don't know why everyone just jumped on that bandwagon.
I hate it. It's because, you know why I hate it? Because
everybody else does.
No, because I'm old, and I
you
like...
You don't like change?
Yes. Okay. And I like things to work the way they've always worked. And if it... My philosophy is if it works and it's not broke, don't fix it.
Don't make it Unity.
Exactly. And I don't know. Maybe in the long run, Ubuntu's doing the right thing and distinguishing themselves the way, because like when you look at Unity, you know Ubuntu canonical. Okay? Mm-hmm. Just like when you see that Mac style, you know, like, that's a Mac. Mm-hmm. You know?
But I thought that, and when I saw it, and again, this was a few months ago, when it came out, they had, I don't know if they had some kind of acceleration with it or some 3D, some aspect to it that I thought really made it look kind of flashy. Now, again, it's from somebody who doesn't run that footprint desktop. GNOME. Just kidding. But anyway, I thought it looked not bad.
I don't know. I am really, really liking Cinnamon. Though I gotta say that those Mint guys just there's a couple of little niggling bugs in it that are kind of annoying to me, like in the taskbar at the bottom. One, you can't right click the taskbar and tell it to make any changes to it. I have yet to figure out how to customize that taskbar, but that's a little annoying. And another thing is sometimes the menus that you get to pop up, like I use Romina a lot for what I do, which is an RDP client for Linux that lets me RDP into Windows machines.
Okay.
And
that's Romina?
It's Romina, R-E-M-M-I-N-A. It's the it's the absolute kick-ass best RDP client I have found for
I'll have to check that out.
So if you need to remote desktop into Windows clients, it's rock solid. It works great. I use it every day. Anyway, but when you start Romina, it continues to run even when you've closed it. It's got a little icon that stays down there in the system tray. Sometimes I want to free up those resources, so I want to close it. So I would right-click on it, and then the menu that pops up is behind the taskbar.
No.
So the close button's at the bottom. But there was a little bitty sliver of it at the top that I could click on to close it. So I actually did switch back to Mate until my laptop died. But I really like that Cinnamon. They just have a couple of little bugs to work out. So
that's cool.
Well, now, I know sometimes you've got the ability to change a setting or something or shift something. That just doesn't exist to allow you to do that.
It's brand new.
Is a bug then.
What the Mint guys have done is they took Genome 3 and they replaced...
Put some Cinnamon on it.
Yeah, they did. They replaced the desktop shell part of Genome 3 with one that they custom wrote that works and acts like Genome 2.3.2. Mm-hmm. And I like it a lot. Like I said, it was the first desktop environment that I ever had installed on a machine where I could just by default hit the Windows key and start typing an application and have it pop up.
It's so. A super key.
Yeah, I almost became a GNOME person.
I have no idea. Sometimes I say GNOME, sometimes I say GNOME.
Well, I tell you what, it was GNOME 1.4, and I can remember I thought, oh, this is such a cool looking desktop, but it kept crashing, I guess, way back. You know, maybe that was an earlier version. And so I ended up going with KDE. But
well, way back in the day, I always liked KDE myself, too, mm-hmm. just because I liked it. I didn't.
Well, your cursor doesn't have to go flying all over the screen for stuff. You stay down near the bottom.
Yeah. And I think the reason I liked it way back then, too, was because it, and we're talking probably 10 years ago, it was much more, I hate to say it, but Windows-like, because I had come from a Windows environment when mm-hmm. I first started running Linux. Mm-hmm. And it was very Windows-like and very easy to learn how to do things in it because it worked almost the same as the Windows environment I had been used to.
Yeah.
But then when they went to that KDE 4, they just torqued me off, and I have not been back since.
You know, I think that's why I like GNOME. It's because it was so much away from Windows. I'm not against Windows, but I need a separation so that I don't get confused between things. It's like when things are so close to it, I'll always hit the same spot, but then on the wrong operating system. So that's, I think, why I wanted to go to GNOME, because it had the menus at the top, so I know that I'm not going to accidentally click on this and this and then hit the wrong thing, you know.
Well, I tell you, I occasionally will work on a Mac, and I still, that right click, not having it, just.
You do know, if you use control click, if you use a USB mouse or something, right click does work in the Mac operating system. If you use
it just used the touchpad.
Okay.
But if you hook up your wireless mouse to the Mac,
I'll try that.
It'll work.
Yeah. Actually, on the touchpad, if you hold down two fingers and click, that's right click. It'll bring up the menu for the right click menu.
Oh, thank you very much. Wow, I learned something about a Mac. Huh?
Yeah, that's our Mac tip of the day.
That's our Mac tip of the day.
Of the year.
Yeah, of the year. Of the series, yeah. Huh, well, I'll try that out. So.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to announce that the MD-LUG meeting today, we had elections for our officers. And in the show right now, all three of us are in the officers.
You're listening to three of them. Yeah.
The new officers.
Yeah.
Actually, so. Tony's not new. Tony was the secretary last year, and he's the secretary.
Our esteemed secretary.
Yeah. Well, actually, we've all been on the officers at one point.
Correct.
That's true.
Mary's been the secretary in the past. And
Yep.
And I've been the secretary in the past.
Treasurer in the past.
And Mary was also treasurer in the past.
And now Mary has returned to the treasurer role.
And I have taken on an unto four head role of president, so.
All right. So should we change this to the MD-LUG?
MD-LUG show? Linux review? Yeah. No.
No.
Yeah. MD-LUG stands for Metro Detroit Linux Users Group, by the way.
Yeah. And, you know, one other thing I was listening this week. I was keeping on listening to that Hacker Public Radio New Year's broadcast.
Yeah.
And they finally released all eight parts. And in that last part, it was the after show. So it was apparently after New Year's. And
probably.
They stopped the official recording, but one guy started recording his own from the same stream. And his name's 5150. So he kept on, he went through his talking and then Ken Fallon, he's the guy that pretty much runs HPR right now. And he had gone to sleep. He got back up and then got back on the show, and they were still recording and running. And he gets on, and 5150's like, you know, Ken, I got to tell you, I got a problem with something here. You guys release so much good stuff, I can't listen to it all. He's like, there's some of these good podcasts out there that are really good, and I want to listen to them, but I don't have time to listen to them all. But one of them was those Sunday morning guys. I'm like, yes, they're talking
there
about
you
us.
Go. That's the plug for Sunday Morning Linux Review of the year. Nobody else is ever going to mention us.
It was cool.
Yeah.
That is nice. That is nice. Well, let's see what else we've got. What else has been happening in the in the land of Linux.
Linux and open source.
That's mm-hmm. the end of my stuff.
And I got nothing else. What about you, Mary?
I don't have anything else right at the moment. But
all right.
I'm, you know, actually, though, in KDE, there's a little feature called Activities. And, you know, it's part of that Plasma desktop.
God, and Matt's rolling his eyes. It sounds really cool, but I don't know how I would use it just because I'm not a power user like
that. I saw an article about that, and I started reading it because the title was misleading. And I thought it was activities about like KDE getting involved in these activities. And then I'm reading, I'm like, what? This isn't what I thought it was. And I stopped reading it.
Well, tell us about it, Mary.
Well, I'm not going to tell you much about it because I don't know much about it, but all I wanted to say is that I'm going to do a little investigating of it because I know that a couple of versions ago, I mean, point versions ago, I don't think that was really a part of the landscape. At least I wasn't aware of it. So now I've installed it, and I've got these larger icon or activity icons at the mm-hmm. bottom. And
you know, you should check out. I can't remember whether Washlug posted the notes from it, but there is a KDE. Presentation a couple months ago, and he went over activities.
Because they actually had a KDE dev.
Yeah, I think that's who it was. And
do that presentation.
He did a really good job, and Activities looks really cool. It's similar to having multiple desktops that you can scroll mm-hmm. between, but each of those desktops are dedicated to a specific activity. But I don't want to say more than that because I don't want to take away from your research. And
oh, no, that's okay. That means I don't have to do as much research. Just kidding. I mean, they've got the photos activity.
Right, so that like your editor and your viewer are all together. Mm-hmm. And I don't know.
Well,
it just sounds retarded to me.
The way he explained it is that you have like your web surfing activity, and then you have your development activities. And then you have your desktop publishing activities.
But now,
I think that would be helpful to me.
No, not for me at all. Because I got my.
That's because guys sort of think linearly. We multitask.
When I'm preparing for the show, I have my web browser open. I have Gedit open, and I have LibreOffice open. Mm-hmm. And I'm switching back between the three and cutting and pasting and rewriting stuff.
That's your editing activity. But if you were. If you were doing something else.
If you like Facebooking and Twittering and
all that.
And IMing, you know, that could be all in a separate activity than from your research and your doing the show stuff.
And so what you'd have to do is rather than cycling through all those windows on that desktop, you could have all that.
I didn't
want to say alt tab.
Alt tab is such a hardship.
Yeah.
Well, when you have 15 windows open. Because you're doing three windows for each.
I have three or four open at the same time.
Yeah, you have three for your editing, and then you have three for your web browsing.
Hey, I don't do. That's a great idea, Tony. I open tabs, and then I can never remember the keyboard shortcut to do the tabs. Yep. But if I open them in different windows, then I could just alt tab through all of it.
Yeah.
Oh.
It uses the same amount of RAM anyway, so it's not like it.
Did I ever tell you
that?
You're a genius.
Thank you.
So anyway, but I thought those KDE activities, and that may even make a good, I was thinking it'd make a good mini presentation, but since it's already been done.
A mini for the lug?
No, that was
we'll
that was Washlug.
Next month.
Yeah, if you want to. That was Washlug that did it. And so we don't have that many people that come out to our meetings, so you can do it too.
But hey, the short presentation next month is from me.
Oh, is it?
On SSHFS. So.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
That should be good. All right.
But that's all I have for this week.
Sweet.
That's all I have.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. This has been episode 14 for the week of January 15th, 2012. Featured music of the week.
We have some my outro music I found.
What is it?
It's actually, his name's Matthew Morris.
And how do you know this guy, Tony?
He's my wife's cousin. I didn't check on his age. I should have. But he's something like 19 or 20. He's pretty young.
Is the music
somewhere in there. It is really good. I mean, I think it's his first original that he's mm-hmm. he's written and recorded. But it's really cool. So take a listen.
Her eyes were shiny as a bright and sunny day. Bright and sunny day. Bright and sunny day. Bright and sunny day. Thank you.
this will never change. Will never change. I'm really glad you came across my way.